Side 5. The Shining Ones. Atomoly, Book 2. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 160.
I've never seen light quite that color before. And it seems to be just lying on the fog itself, almost like a blanket.
It's probably just the camp of some desert nomads, Sir Olaf, Itanya suggested. Mist and fog do strange things to light sometimes. In Mytherian, you'll see light reflected off the Mother of Pearl on the buildings. Some nights, it's like walking around inside a rainbow.
We'll know more about it in a little bit, Calton said. That fog's moving right straight toward us, and it's bringing the light with it.
He raised his face.
And there's absolutely no breeze. What's going on here, Sophronia?
Before she could answer, shrieks of terror came from the south, where the road was. Talon scurried across the littered yard to the tumbled wall.
The Seergai are running away, he shouted. They're throwing away their swords and helmets and running like rabbits.
I don't like the feel of this, Sparhawk, Calton said bleakly, drawing his sword.
The fog bank approaching them had divided and flowed around the hill upon which they stood. It was a thick fog, such as one might see in a coastal city, and it moved across the arid, barren desert, marching inexorably upon the ruined fortress.
"There's something moving in there," Talon shouted from the far side of the ruin.
They were only blurs of light at first, but as the strange fog bank drew nearer, they grew more and more distinct. Sparhawk could clearly make out the shapes of nebulous bodies now. Whatever they were, they had human shapes. Then Sophronia shrieked as one seized in the grip of an overpowering rage.
"Defiled ones! Defiled ones! Foul and accursed!"
They stared at her, stunned by her sudden outburst. The lights in the fog never faltered, but continued their glowing, inexorable advance.
"Run!" Itanya suddenly shouted. "Run for your lives! It's the Delphae! The Shining Ones!"
Part 2. Delphaeus. Chapter 11. It was the fog, perhaps. The fog blurred everything. There were no precise outlines, no clear, sharp dangers, and the glowing figures in the mist approached slowly, seeming almost to float up the graveled slope toward the ancient ruin, bringing their obscuring fog with them. Their faces, their very shapes, were indistinct, softened until they seemed hardly more than glowing blurs. It was the fog, perhaps, but then again, perhaps not. For whatever reason, Sparhawk felt no alarm. The Delphae stopped about 20 yards from the broken walls of the ruin, and stood with their glowing fog eddying and swirling around them, erasing the night with cold, pale fire. Sparhawk's mind was strangely detached, his thoughts clear and precise.
"Well met, neighbors," he called out to the shapes in the mist.
"Are you mad?"
Itanya gasped.
"Destroy them, Sparhawk," Sophronia hissed. "Use the bellium. Obliterate them."
"Why don't we see what they want first?"
"How can you be so calm, man?" Itanya demanded.
"Training, I suppose." Sparhawk shrugged. "You develop instincts after a while. Those people out there don't have any hostile intentions."
"He's right, Itanya," Vanyan said. "You can definitely feel it when someone wants to kill you. Those people out there don't want to fight. They're not afraid of us, but they're not here to fight. Let's see where this goes, gentlemen. Keep your guard up, but let's not precipitate anything. Not yet, anyway."
"Annika," one of the glowing figures in the fog called.
"That's a good start," Vanyan murmured. "See what they want, Sparhawk."
Sparhawk nodded and stepped closer to the time-eroded boulders of the fallen wall.
"You know me?" he called, speaking in Tamil.
"The very rocks know the name of Annika. Thou art as no other man who hath ever lived."
The language was archaic and profoundly formal.
"We bear thee no malice, and we come in friendship."
"I'll listen to what you have to say."
Sparhawk heard Sophronia's sharp intake of breath behind him.
"We offer thee and thy companions sanctuary, the Delphi out in the fog told him. Thine enemies are all about thee, and thy peril is great here in the land of the Seer Guy. Come thou even unto Delphaeus, and we will give thee rest and safety.
Your offer is generous, neighbor, Sparhawk replied, and my companions and I are grateful.
His tone, however, was dubious. We sense thy reluctance. The voice in the fog seemed strangely hollow, with a sort of reverberating echo to it, an echo such as one might hear in a long, empty corridor, a sound receding off into some immeasurable distance. Be assured that we mean thee and thy companions no harm, and shouldst thou choose to come to Delphaeus, we will pledge thee our protection. Few there are in all this world who will willingly face us.
So I've heard. But that brings up a question. Why, neighbor? We're strangers here. What possible interest can the Delphae have in our affairs? What do you hope to gain from this offer of friendship?
The glowing shape in the fog hesitated. Thou hast taken up Belium, Annika, for good or for ill, and thou knowest not which. Thy will is no longer thine own, for Belium bends thee to its own purpose. Thou art no longer of this world, nor is thy destiny. Thy design and thy destiny are of Belium's devising. In truth, we are indifferent to thee and thy companions, for our offer of friendship is not to thee, but to Belium, and it is from Belium that we will extract the price of that friendship.
That's direct enough, Colton muttered.
Thy peril is greater than thou knowest, the glowing speaker continued. Belium is the greatest prize in all the universe, and beings beyond thine imagining seek to possess it. It will not be possessed, however. It chooseth its own, and it hath chosen thee. Into thy hand hath it placed itself, and through thine ears must we speak with it and offer our exchange. The speaker paused. Consider what we have told thee here, and put aside thy suspicion. Thy success or failure in completing Belium's design may hinge on our assistance, or its lack, and we will have our price. We will speak more of this anon. The fog swirled and thickened, and the glowing shapes dimmed and faded. A sudden night breeze, as chill as winter and as arid as dust, swept across the desert, and the fog tattered and shawled, whirling, all seethe and confusion. And then it was gone, and the Shining Ones with it.
Don't listen to them, Sparhawk, Sophronia said in a shrill voice. Don't even consider what he said. It's a trick.
We're not children, Sophronia, Vanyan told the woman he loved. We're not really gullible enough to accept the word of strangers at face value. Particularly not the word of strangers like the Delphae.
You don't know them, Banyan. Their words are like the honey that lures and traps the unwary fly. You should have destroyed them, Sparhawk.
Sophronia, Banyan said in a troubled tone. You've spent the last 40 years with your hand on my sword arm, trying to keep me from hurting people. Why have you changed? What's making you so bloodthirsty all of a sudden?
She gave him a flat, hostile look.
You wouldn't understand.
That's an evasion, dear, and you know me well enough to know that it's probably not true. The Delphae may not have been entirely candid with us about their offer, but they weren't hostile, and they weren't threatening us in any way.
Lord Vanyan, Uloth interrupted. I don't think anybody in his right mind would threaten Sparhawk. Threatening the man who holds Belium in his fist is not the course of wisdom. Not even for people who glow in the dark and mulch their neighbors down into compost.
That's exactly my point, Vanyan, Sophronia seized upon Uloth's words. The Delphae were afraid to attack us because of Belium. That's all that was holding them back.
But they were holding back. They weren't any danger to us. Why did you want Sparhawk to kill them?
I despise them. It came out in a kind of hiss.
Why? What did they ever do to you?
They have no right to exist.
Everything has a right to exist, Sophrenia. Even wasps and scorpions. You've spent your whole life teaching bloodthirsty young Pandians that lesson. Why are you suddenly throwing it away?
She turned her face away from him.
Please don't do that. You've got some kind of problem here, and your problems are mine. Let's pull this out into the light and look at it.
No!
And she turned abruptly on her heel and stalked away.
It has absolutely no basis in fact, Itania told them as they rode across the barren miles under a murky sky.
Those are usually the best stories, Talon said. Itania smiled briefly.
There's been a body of folklore about the Shining Ones in Tamil culture for eons. It started out with the usual horror stories, I suppose, but there's something in the Tamil nature that drives us to extremes. About 700 years ago, a decidedly minor poet began to tamper with the legend. Instead of concentrating on the horror, he began to wax sentimental, delving into how the Delphae felt about their situation. He wept copiously in vile verse about their loneliness and their sense of being outcast. He unfortunately turned to the pastoral tradition and added the mawkishness of that silly conceit to his other extravagances. His most famous work was a long narrative poem entitled Zadani. Zadani was supposedly a Delphaic shepherdess who fell in love with a normal human shepherd boy. As long as they met in the daytime, everything was fine. But Zadani had to run away every afternoon to keep her paramour from discovering her real identity. The poem's very long and tedious, and it's filled with lengthy, lugubrious passages in which Zadani feels sorry for herself. It's absolutely awful.
I gather from what those people out in the fog said last night that the word Delphae is their own name for themselves, Bevier noted. If Tamil literature also uses the term, that would seem to suggest some sort of contact.
So it would, Sir Knight, Itania replied. But there's no record of them. The traditions are very old, and I suspect that many of them grew out of the warped minds of third-rate poets. The city of Delphaeus supposedly lies in an isolated valley high in the mountains of southern Aton. The Delphae are said to be a Tamil people somewhat akin to the Atons, but without the gigantic proportions. If we are to believe our poets, which we probably shouldn't, the Delphae were a simple pastoral folk who followed their flocks into that valley and were trapped there by an avalanche that sealed the only pass leading to the outside world.
That's not entirely impossible, Uloth said.
The impossibilities start cropping up later on in the story, Itania said dryly. We are told that there's a lake in the center of the valley, and the lake's supposed to be the source of the Delphaic peculiarity. It's said to glow, and since it's the only source of water in the valley, the Delphae and their flocks are forced to drink from it and bathe in it. The story has it that after a while they also started to glow. He smiled faintly. They must save a fortune on candles. That's really not possible, is it? Talon asked skeptically. I mean, people aren't going to glow in the dark just because of what they eat or drink, are they? I'm not a scientist, young sir, so don't ask me about what's possible and impossible. It could be some sort of mineral, or maybe a form of algae, I suppose. It's a neat sort of explanation for an imaginary characteristic.
Those people last night did glow, Your Excellency, Colton reminded him.
Yes, and I'm trying very hard to forget about that.
Itania looked back over his shoulder. Sophrenia had refused to listen to any discussion of the Delphae, and she and Barrett followed the others at some distance.
Lady Sophrenia's reaction to the Delphae isn't really uncommon among Styrics, you know. The very name makes them irrational. Anyway, Zetany enjoyed enormous popularity, and there were the usual imitators. A whole body of literature grew up around the Delphae. It's called, quite naturally, Delphaic literature. Serious people don't take it seriously, and foolish people take it foolishly. You know how that goes.
Oh, yes, Bevier murmured. I had to read whole libraries full of abominable verse when I was a student. Every professor had his favorite poet, and they all inflicted them on us without mercy. I think that's what ultimately led me to take up a military career.
Khalad came riding back to join them.
I wouldn't want to seem critical of my betters, my lords, he said dryly, but the decision to abandon the road and cut across country may have been just a little ill-advised on a day when we can't see the sun. Does anyone know which way we're going?
East,
Vanyan said firmly.
Yes, my lord,
Khalad replied.
If you say it's east, then it's east, even if it really isn't. Aren't we supposed to be getting fairly close to the border?
It shouldn't be very far ahead.
Doesn't your map indicate that the river Sarna marks the boundary between Seneska and Tamil proper?
Vanyan nodded.
Well, I just rode to the top of that hill up ahead and took a look around. I could see for about 10 leagues in every direction, and there aren't any rivers out there. Do you suppose that someone might have stolen the Sarna?
Be nice, Sparhawk murmured.
Cartography's not an exact art, Khalad,
Vanyan pointed out.
The distances on any map are only approximate. We started out at dawn, and we rode toward the lightest place in the cloud cover. Unless somebody's changed things, that's east. We've taken sightings on landmarks every hour or so, and we're still riding in the same direction we were when we set out this morning.
Where's the river, then, my lord?
Khalad asked, then looked at Itanya.
How wide would you say the valley of the Sarna is, Your Excellency?
60 leagues, anyway. It's the longest and widest river on the continent, and the valley's very fertile.
Grass, trees, lots of green crops?
Itanya nodded.
There's not a hint of green in any direction, my lords,
Khalad declared.
It's all a brown wasteland.
We're riding east, Vanyan insisted. The mountains of Aton should be to the north, off to the left.
They could be, my lord, but they're a little bashful today. They're hiding themselves in the clouds.
I've told you, Khalad, the map's inaccurate, that's all.
Vanyan looked back over his shoulder.
Why don't you ride back and ask Sophrenia and Barrett to join us? It's about lunchtime, isn't it, Carlton?
Definitely, my lord.
I sort of thought so myself. Let's dig into the packs and put together something to eat.
Is Sir Carlton skilled at estimating the time?
Itanya asked Sparhawk. Sparhawk smiled.
We normally rely on Khalad when the sun's out. When it's cloudy, though, we fall back on Carlton's stomach. He can usually tell you to within a minute how long it's been since the last time he ate.
Late that afternoon, when they had stopped for the night, Khalad stood a short distance from where the rest of them were setting up their encampment. He was looking out over the featureless desert with a slightly smug expression on his face.
Sparhawk,
he called.
Could you come here a moment? I want to show you something.
Sparhawk put down Farron's saddle and walked over to join his squire.
Yes? He asked.
I think you'd better talk with Lord Vanyan. He probably won't listen to me, since he's already got his mind made up. But somebody's going to have to convince him that we haven't been riding east today.
You're going to have to convince me first.
All right.
The husky young man pointed out across the desert.
We came from that direction, right?
Yes.
If we've been riding east, that would be west, right?
You're being obvious.
Yes, I know. I have to be. I'm trying to explain something to a knight. The last time I looked, the sun went down in the west.
Please, Khalad, don't try to be clever. Just get to the point.
Yes, my lord. If that's west, then why is the sun going down over there?
He turned and pointed off toward the left, where an angry orange glow stained the clouds. Sparhawk blinked, and then he muttered an oath.
Let's go talk to Vanyan, he said, and led the way back across the camp to where the Pandian preceptor was speaking with Sophrenia. We've got a problem, Sparhawk told them. We made a wrong turn somewhere today.
Are you still riding that tired horse, Khalad?
Vanyan's tone was irritable. His conversation with Sophrenia had obviously not been going well.
Our young friend here just pointed something out to me, Sparhawk said. Speaking slowly, of course, because of my limited understanding. He says that unless somebody's moved the sun, we've been riding north all day.
That's impossible.
Sparhawk turned and pointed toward the ugly orange glow on the horizon.
That's not the direction we came from, Vanyan.
Vanyan stared at the horizon for a moment,
and then he started to swear.
"You wouldn't listen to me, would you?" Sophronia accused. "Now will you believe me when I tell you that the Delphi will deceive you at every turn?"
"It was our own mistake, Sophronia. Well, mine, anyway. We can't just automatically blame the Delphi for everything that goes wrong."
"I've known you since you were a boy, Vanyan, and you've never made this kind of mistake before. I've seen you find your way on a dark night in the middle of a snowstorm."
"I must have confused a couple of landmarks and taken my bearings on the wrong one." Vanyan grimaced. "Thanks for being so polite about it, Khalad, and so patient. We could have ridden on until we ran into the polar ice. I tend to get pig-headed sometimes."
Sophronia smiled fondly at him.
"I much prefer to speak of your singleness of purpose, dear one," she told him.
"It means the same thing, doesn't it?"
"Yes, but it sounds nicer."
"Set out some markers, Khalad," Vanyan instructed.
He looked around.
"There aren't any sticks lying around, so pile up heaps of rock and mark them with scraps of colored cloth. Let's get an absolute reference on the position of the sun this evening, so that we don't make the same mistake again tomorrow morning."
"I'll take care of it, my lord."
"They're back," Kalton said, roughly shaking Sparhawk awake.
"Who's back?"
Sparhawk sat up.
"Your glowing friends. They want to talk with you again."
Sparhawk rose to his feet and followed his friend to the edge of the camp.
"I was standing watch," Kalton said quietly, "and they just appeared out of nowhere. Itanya's stories are entertaining enough, but I don't think they're all that accurate. The Shining Ones don't shine all the time. They crept up on me in the dark, and they didn't start to glow until they were in place."
"Are they still staying back a ways?"
Kalton nodded.
"They're keeping their distance. There's no way we could rush them."
There was no fog this time, and there were only two of the Shining Ones standing about 20 yards from the picketed horses. The eerie glow emanating from them still blurred their features, however.
"Thy peril increases, Annika," that same hollow, echoing voice declared. "Thine enemies are seeking thee up and down in the land."
"We haven't seen anyone, neighbor."
"It is the unseen enemy which is most perilous. It is with their minds that thine enemies seek thee. We urge thee to accept our offer of sanctuary. It may soon be too late."
"I wouldn't offend you for the world, neighbor, but we've only got your word for this unseen danger, and I think you may be exaggerating a bit. You said that Belium's directing my steps, and Belium has unlimited power. I've tested that myself a few times. Thanks for your concern, but I still think I can take care of myself and my friends."
He paused a moment, and then plunged ahead on an impulse.
"Why don't we just cut across all this polite chit-chat? You've already admitted to a certain self-interest here. Why don't you come right out and tell me what you want and what you're prepared to offer in exchange? That might give us a basis for negotiation."
"Your charm's positively blinding, Sparhawk," Kalton muttered.
"We will consider thy proposal, Annika." The echoing voice was cold.
"Do that. Oh, one other thing, neighbor. Stop tampering with our direction. Deceit and trickery at the outset always seem to get negotiations off on the wrong foot."
The glowing Delphi did not respond, but receded back into the desert and slipped out of sight.
"Then you do believe me, don't you, Sparhawk?"
Sophronia said from just behind the two knights.
"You realize how unprincipled and dishonest those creatures are."
"Let's just say that I'm keeping an open mind on the subject, little mother. You were absolutely right about what you said earlier, though. We could blindfold Vanyan, spin him around in circles for a day or so, and he'd still come out pointing due north."
He looked around.
"Is everybody awake? I think we'd better start considering options."
They returned to the place where their beds were laid out on the hard, uncomfortable gravel.
"You're really very clever, Sparhawk," Bevier said. "The fact that our visitors didn't deny that accusation you pulled out of the air
suggests that Sophrenia's been right about them all along. They have been misdirecting us.
That doesn't alter the fact that the Seer Guy are out there, Uloth reminded him, and the Seer Guy are definitely our enemies. We may not know what the Delphae are really up to, but they ran off the Seer Guy for us last night, and that sort of inclines me to like them.
Could that have been some sort of collusion? Barret asked.
That's very unlikely, Itanya said. The Seer Guy traditionally have a sublime belief that they are the crown of creation. They'd never agree to any ruse that put them in a subservient position, not even for the sake of appearances. It's just not in their racial makeup.
He's right, Sophrenia agreed. And even though I hate to admit it, an alliance of that sort would be totally out of character for the Delphae as well. There could be no common ground between them and the Seer Guy. I don't know what the Delphae are doing in this business, but they have their own agenda. It wouldn't be cat's paws for anyone else.
Wonderful, Talon said sardonically. Now we've got two enemies to worry about.
Why worry at all? Colton shrugged. Belium can put us down on the outskirts of Matherion in the space between two heartbeats. Why don't we just go away and leave the Seer Guy and the Delphae here in this wasteland to resolve their differences without us?
No,
Sophrenia said. Why not?
Because the Delphae have misdirected us already. We don't want to go to Delphaeus.
They're not going to be able to fool the Belium, Sophrenia, Venian disagreed. They might have been able to confuse me, but Belium's an entirely different matter.
I don't think we can take that chance, dear one. The Delphae want something from Sparhawk, and it's obviously going to involve Belium. Let's not deliver them both into Delphaic hands. I know that it's tedious and dangerous, but let's keep our feet on the ground. Belium moves through a vast emptiness. If the Delphae can deceive it, we could come out of that emptiness almost any place.
What's an eclogue? Talon asked. They were riding toward what they hoped was the east the following morning, and Itanya was considering his rambling discourse on Delphaic literature.
It's a sort of primitive drama, he replied. It usually involves a meeting between two shepherds. They stand around discussing philosophy in bad verse.
I've known a few sheepherders, Khalad said, and philosophy wasn't their usual topic of conversation. They're far more interested in women.
There's some of that involved in eclogues as well, but it's so idealized that it's hardly recognizable.
Itanya tugged thoughtfully at one earlobe.
I think it's some sort of disease, he mused. The more civilized people become, the more they romanticize the simple bucolic life and ignore the dirt and grinding toil involved. Our sillier poets grow all weepy-eyed about shepherds, and shepherdesses, of course. It wouldn't be nearly as much fun without the shepherdesses. The aristocracy periodically becomes enamored of the pastoral tradition, and they go to great lengths to act out their fantasies. Emperor Sarabian's father even went so far as to have an idealized sheep farm built down near Sarant. He and his court used to go there in the summertime and spend months pretending to watch over flocks of badly overfed sheep. Their rude smocks and kirtles were made of velvet and satin, and they'd sit around all moony-eyed, composing bad verse, and ignoring the fact that their sheep were wandering off in all directions. He leaned back in his saddle. Pastoral literature doesn't really hurt anything. It's silly and grossly over-sentimental, and the poets who become addicted to it tend to be a bit heavy-handed when they ladle on the moral lessons. That's always been the problem with literature, finding a justification for it. It really doesn't serve any practical purpose, you know.
Except that life without it would be sterile and empty, Bevier asserted.
It would indeed, Sir Bevier, Itanya agreed. Anyway, Delphaic literature, which probably doesn't have anything at all to do with the real Delphae, grew up around these ridiculous literary conventions. But after several centuries of that nonsense, the potentials of the pastoral tradition had been pretty much exhausted, so our poets began to wander afield, like untended sheep, if I may extend the metaphor. Sometime during the last century, they began to posit the notion that the Delphae practice a non-steric form of magic,
That really upsets my steric colleagues at the university.
Itania looked back over his shoulder to make sure that Sophrenia, who still rode in the rear with Barrett, was out of earshot.
Many people find something fundamentally irritating about Styrics. The pudding of smug superiority and accusatory self-pity doesn't cook up very well, and the favorite form of Styric baiting on the university campus is to mention Delphaic magic to a Styric, and then watch him go up in flames.
Can you think of anything at all that might explain Sophrenia's reaction to the Delphae?
Venian asked with troubled eyes.
I've never seen her behave this way before.
I really don't know Lady Sophrenia that well, Lord Venian, but her explosion the first time I mentioned Delphaic literature provides some clues. There's a very brief passage in Zedony that hints that the Delphae were allied with the Styrix during the war that was supposed to have exterminated the Seergai. The passage was clearly based on a very obscure section in a 7th-century historical text. There's mention of a betrayal, but not much more. Evidently, when their war with the Seergai began, the Styrix contacted the Delphae and tricked them into mounting an attack on the Seergai from the east. They promised aid and all manner of other inducements, but when the Seergai counterattacked and began to overrun the Delphae, the Styrix chose to renege on their promises. The Delphae were almost exterminated. The Styrix have been wriggling and squirming for eons, trying to justify that blatant breach of faith. There are many people in the world who don't like Styrix, and they've used that betrayal as a vehicle for their bigotry. Styrix, quite understandably, don't care much for the literature.
He looked pensively out across the featureless desert.
One of the less attractive aspects of human nature is our tendency to hate the people we haven't treated very well. It's much easier than accepting guilt if we can convince ourselves that the people we betrayed or enslaved were subhuman monsters in the first place. Then our guilt isn't nearly as black as we secretly know that it is. Humans are very, very good at shifting blame and avoiding guilt. We do like to keep a good opinion of ourselves, don't we?
I think it would take more than that to set Sophrenia off,
Venian said dubiously.
She's too sensible to catch on fire just because somebody says unflattering things about Styrix. She spent several hundred years in the Aline kingdoms of Eosia, and anti-Styric prejudice there goes far beyond literary insults.
He sighed.
If she'd only talk to me about it. I can't get anything coherent out of her, though. All she does is splutter wild denunciations. I don't understand at all.
Sparhawk, however, had an inkling of what was happening. Afriel had hinted that Sophrenia was going to encounter something extraordinarily painful, and it was growing increasingly obvious that the Delphae would be the cause of her pain. Afriel had said that Sophrenia's suffering would be necessary as a prelude to some kind of growth. Itania, who didn't really know any of them that well, may have hit upon something relevant. Sophrenia was Styric to her fingertips, and the acceptance of racial guilt for an eons-old misbehavior would cause her the exact kind of pain Afriel had so sorrowfully described. Sophrenia, however, would not be the only one who would suffer. Vanyan had said that Sophrenia's problems were also his. Unfortunately, the same held true of her pain. Sparhawk rode on across the desolate waste, his thoughts as bleak as the surroundings. Chapter 12. Kring looked pensively out across the lawn.
It came on me like a madness, Eitan and Gessa, he told his towering friend. From the moment I first saw her, I couldn't think of anything else.
The two were standing in the shadows near the Ministry of the Interior.
You are fortunate, friend Kring, Engessa replied in his deep, soft voice. Most men's lives are never touched by such love.
Kring smiled a bit wryly.
I'm sure my life would be much easier if it hadn't touched mine.
Do you regret it?
Not for a moment. I'd thought that my life was full. I was the domi of my people, and I'd assumed that my mother would find me a suitable wife in due time, as is customary and proper. I'd have married and fathered sons, and that would have satisfied the requirements.
Then I saw Mirtai, and I realized how empty my life had been before. He rubbed one hand over his shaved scalp. My people will have a great deal of trouble with her, I'm afraid. She's like no other woman we've ever encountered. It wouldn't be so difficult if I weren't the Domi.
She might not have accepted you if you hadn't been, friend Kring. Mirtai is a proud woman. She was meant to be the wife of a ruler.
I know. I wouldn't have dared to approach her if I hadn't been Domi. There'll be trouble, though. I can see that coming. She's a stranger, and she's not at all like Paloi women. Status is very important to our women, and Mirtai's of a different race. She's taller than even the tallest of the Paloi men, and she's more beautiful than any other woman I've ever seen. Just by themselves, those things would shrivel the hearts of Paloi women. You saw how Takumi's wife Vita looked at her, didn't you? And Gessa nodded. The women of my people will hate her all the more, because I am their Domi. She will be Doma, the Domi's wife, and she'll have first place among the women. To make matters even worse, she'll be one of the wealthiest of all the Paloi.
I don't understand.
I've done quite well. My herds have increased, and I've stolen much. All my wealth will belong to her. She'll own vast herds of sheep and cattle. The horse herds will still be mine, though.
Is that the Paloi custom?
Oh, yes. Sheep and cattle are food, so they belong to the women. The women also own the tents and the beds and the wagons. The gold we get from the king for Zemach ears is owned by all the people in common. So about the only thing we Paloi men own are our weapons and our horses. When you get right down to it, the women own everything, and we spend our lives protecting their possessions.
You have a strange society, friend Kring.
Kring shrugged. A man shouldn't have his mind all cluttered with possessions. It distracts him when the time comes for fighting.
There's wisdom there, my friend. Who holds your possessions until you marry?
My mother. She's a sensible woman, and having a daughter like Mirtai will increase her status enormously. She has a great deal of authority among the Paloi women, and I'm hoping she'll be able to keep matters under control, at least among my sisters. He laughed. I'm going to enjoy watching the faces of my sisters when I introduce them to Mirtai, and they have to bow to her. I'm not really fond of them. They all pray for my death every night.
Your own sisters?
And Gessa sounded shocked. Of course. If I die before I'm married, everything I've won becomes the property of my mother, and my sisters will inherit all of it. They already think of themselves as women of property. They've turned down perfectly acceptable suitors because of their pride of position and the wealth they think they'll inherit. I've been too busy making war to think much about marriage, and every year that passed made my sisters feel that their ownership of the herds was that much more secure. He grinned. Mirtai's sudden appearance is going to upset them, I'm afraid. One of the customs of our people obliges a bride-to-be to spend 2 months in the tent of her betrothed's mother, learning all the little things she'll need to know about him after they're married. During that period, my mother and Mirtai will also select husbands for all my sisters. It's not a good idea to have too many women in one tent. That will really upset my sisters. I expect they'll try to murder Mirtai. I'll warn them against it, of course, he added piously. I am their brother, after all. But I'm sure they won't listen. At least not until after Mirtai's killed a few of them. I've got too many sisters anyway.
How many?
Engesa asked him. 8. Their status will change drastically once I marry. Right now, they're all heiresses. After my wedding, they'll be possessionless spinsters, dependent on Mirtai for every crust of bread they eat. I think they'll bitterly regret all the suitors they've refused at that point. Is that somebody creeping through the shadows over by the wall?
And Gessa looked toward the interior ministry. It seems to be, he replied. Let's go ask him his business. We don't really want anybody going inside that building while Etana Mirtai and the thieves are in there.
Right, Kring agreed.
He loosened his saber in its sheath, and the oddly mismatched pair moved silently across the lawn to intercept the furtive shadow near the wall.
How far is it from here to Tiga, Saravian?
Elana asked, looking up from Sparhawk's letter.
In a direct line, I mean.
Saravian had removed his doublet, and he really looked quite dashing in his tight-fitting hose and full-sleeved linen shirt. He had tied back his shoulder-length black hair, and he was practicing lunges with his rapier, aiming at a golden bracelet hanging from the ceiling on a long string.
About 150 leagues, wouldn't you say, Oscania? He replied, contorting his body into on-guard position.
He lunged and caught the rim of the bracelet with the point of his rapier, sending the bracelet spinning and swinging on the string.
Blast!
He muttered. Perhaps closer to 175, Your Majesty, Oscania corrected.
Could it really be raining there? Elana asked. The weather's been beautiful here. 175 leagues isn't really all that far. And Sparhawk says right here that it's been raining on Tiga for the past week.
Who can say what the weather's going to do? Sarabian lunged again, and his rapier passed smoothly through the bracelet.
Well thrust, Elana said a bit absently.
Thank you, Your Majesty. Sarabian bowed, flourishing his rapier.
This is really fun, you know that?
He crouched melodramatically.
Have at you, dog!
He lunged at the bracelet again, missing by several inches.
Blast! Aileen, dear, Elana said to her maid, would you go see if the sailor who brought this letter is still on the premises?
At once, my queen.
Sarabian looked inquiringly at his hostess.
The sailor just came from Tiga. I think I'd like to hear his views on the weather there.
Surely you don't think your husband would lie to Your Majesty, do you?
Oscania protested.
Why not? I'd lie to him if there was a valid political reason for it. Elana!
Sarabian sounded profoundly shocked.
I thought you loved Sparhawk. What on earth has that got to do with it? Of course I love him. I've loved him since I was about Danae's age. But love and politics are two entirely different things, and they should never be mixed. Sparhawk's up to something, Sarabian, and your excellent foreign minister here probably knows what it is.
Me?
Oscania protested mildly.
Yes, you.
Mermaids, Oscania?
Mermaids?
You didn't really think I'd swallow that story, did you?
I'm just a bit disappointed in you, actually. Was that the best you could come up with?
I was a bit pressed for time, Your Majesty, he apologized with a slightly embarrassed look.
Prince Sparhawk was in a hurry to leave. Was it the weather that gave us away?
Partly, she replied. She held up the letter.
My beloved outsmarted himself, though. I've seen his letters before. The notion of felicity of style has never occurred to Sparhawk. His letters usually read as if he'd written them with his broadsword. This one, and all the others from Tiga, have been polished until they glisten. I'm touched that he went to all the trouble, but I don't believe one word of them. Now then, where is he, and what's he really up to?
He wouldn't say, Your Majesty. All he told me was that he needed some excuse to be away from Etherion for several weeks.
She smiled sweetly at him.
That's all right, Oscania, she said. I'll find out for myself. It's more fun that way, anyhow.
It's a big building, Stragan reported the following morning. It's going to take time to go over it inch by inch.
He, Kalador, and Mirtai had just returned from their night of unsuccessful burglary. Have you made much progress? Sarabian asked.
We've covered the top 2 floors, Your Majesty, Kalador replied. We'll start on the 3rd floor tonight.
Kalador was sprawled in a chair, with a weary look on his face. Like his 2 companions, he was still dressed in tight-fitting black clothing. He stretched and yawned.
God, I'm tired, he said. I'm getting too old for this.
Stragan unrolled a time-yellowed set of drawings.
I still think that the answer's right here, he said. Instead of opening doors and poking under desks, we should be matching dimensions against these drawings.
You're still a-thinkin' there's secret passages and corn-sealed rooms in thar, ain't you, Stragan?
Galador drawled, yawning again.
That doesn't speak too well for your taste in literature, old boy.
Sarabian gave him a puzzled look. The Legions are addicted to bad ghost stories, Your Majesty, Galador explained.
It gives the copying houses and MSAT something to do, now that they've exhausted the body of real literature.
Stragan shrugged.
We've got a whole subgenre of highly popular books spewing out of grubby garrets on back streets. Lurid narratives that all take place in cemeteries or in haunted houses on dark and stormy nights. The whores of MSAT absolutely adore them. I rather expect the policemen at Interior share that taste. After all, a policeman's sort of like a whore, isn't he?
I didn't exactly follow that, Mirtai said, and I'm not really sure I want to. There's probably something disgusting involved in your thinking, Stragan. Galador, will you stop yawning like that? Your face looks like an open barn door.
I'm sleepy, little Dorlin. You two been a-keepin' me up past my bedtime.
Then go to bed. You make my jaws ache when you gape at me like that.
You should all get some sleep, Elana told them. You're the official royal burglars now, and Sarabian and I would be absolutely mortified if you were to fall asleep in mid-burgle.
Are we ready to be practical about this? Kalador asked, rising to his feet. I can have 24 professionals here by this evening, and we'll have all the secrets of the Interior Ministry in our hands by tomorrow morning.
And Interior will know that we have them by tomorrow afternoon, Stragan added. Our impromptu spy network isn't really all that secure, Kalador. We haven't had enough time to weed out all the people Krager's probably subverted.
There's no real rush here, gentlemen, Elana told them. Even if we do find the documents the policemen at Interior are hiding, we won't be able to do a thing about them until my wandering husband finds his way home again.
Why are you so positive that Sparhawk's deceiving you, Elana? Sarabian asked her.
It's consistent with his character. Sparhawk's devoted his entire life to protecting me. It's rather sweet, even though it is bloody hindering awkward at times. He still thinks of me as a little girl, although I've demonstrated to him on any number of occasions that I'm not. He's out there doing something dangerous, and he doesn't want me to worry. All he really had to do was tell me what he was planning, and then lay out the reasons why he thought it was necessary. I know it's hard for you men to believe, but women are rational, too, and far more practical than you are.
You're a hard woman, Elana, Sarabian accused.
No, I'm a realist. Sparhawk does what he thinks he has to, no matter what I say, and I've learned to accept that. The point I'm trying to make is that no matter what we dig out of the walls of the Interior Ministry, there's absolutely nothing we can do about it while Sparhawk and the others are out there wandering around the countryside. We're going to disband Interior and throw about 25% of the Empire's policemen in prison. Then we're going to place all of Tomalley under martial law, with the Aetons enforcing our decrees. The Deresian continent's going to look like an anthill that's just been run over by a cavalry charge. I don't know what Sparhawk's doing, so I don't know what kind of impact that chaos is going to have on him. I am not going to let you put him in any more danger than I think he's already in.
Do you know something, Elana? Sarabian said. You're even more protective of Sparhawk than he is of you.
Of course I am. That's what marriage is all about.
None of mine are, he sighed.
That's because you've got too many wives, Sarabian. Your affection's dispersed. Your wives each return only as much love as you give them.
I've found that it's safer that way.
But dull, my friend, and sort of boring. Being consumed with a burning passion that only has a single object is very exciting. It's sort of like living in a volcano.
What an exhausting prospect. He shuddered.
Fun, though.
She smiled. Baroness Melodir had retired early, pleading a painful headache. It was not that she found her duties as Elana's lady-in-waiting onerous, but rather that she had an important decision to make, and she knew that the longer she put it off, the more difficult it would be. To put it rather bluntly, the Baroness had reached the point where she was going to have to decide what to do about Stragan. Melodir was no innocent. Few members of any court really are. An innocent girl has only one option in her dealings with the opposite sex. A more worldly girl has two. And this was the crux of Melodir's dilemma. Stragan, of course, would make a perfectly acceptable paramour. He was presentable, interesting, and he had exquisite manners. Melodir's reputation at court would not be tarnished by a liaison with him. Quite the reverse, actually. That had originally been her intention, and the time had come for her to take the final step and to invite him to her bedchamber and have done with it. The liaison could be brief, or it could be extended, renewed each time Stragan visited Samura. That would give the affair a certain status, while at the same time leaving them both free to pursue other amusements, as was normal in such situations. Melodir, however, was not sure if that was all she wanted. More and more of late, she had found herself thinking of a more permanent arrangement. And therein lay the dilemma. There is a rhythm, almost a tide, in the affairs of the heart. When that tide reaches its high point, a lady must give certain signals to her quarry. One set of signals points toward the bedchamber, the other toward the altar. Melodir could no longer put it off. She had to decide which set of signal flags to hoist. Stragan intrigued her. There was a sense of dangerous excitement about him, and Melodir, a creature of the court, was attracted by that. It could be intoxicating, addictive. But she was not entirely sure that the excitement would not begin to pall as the years went by. There was, moreover, the problem of Stragan himself. His irregular origins and lack of any official status had made him overly sensitive, and he continually imagined slights where none had been intended. He hovered around the edges of Aelana's court like an uninvited guest at a banquet, always fearful that he might be summarily ejected. He had the outsider's awe of the nobility, seeming at times to view aristocrats almost as members of another species. Melodir knew that if she decided to marry him, she would have to attack that first. She personally knew that titles were a sham, and that legitimacy could be purchased. But how was she going to persuade Stragan of that? She could easily buy him out of bastardy and into the aristocracy, but that would mean that she would have to reveal the secret she had kept locked in her heart since childhood. Melodir had always concealed the fact that she was one of the wealthiest people at court, largely because her fabulous wealth had not been legally obtained. And there it was. She almost laughed when she realized how simple it was. If she really wanted to marry Stragan, all she'd have to do is share her secret with him. That would put them on equal footing and tear down the largely imaginary barrier. Melodir was a baroness, but her title had not been in her family for very long. Her father had begun life as a blacksmith in Cardos, a man with huge shoulders and a mop of curly blonde hair, and he had amassed a fortune with a simple invention which he had crafted in his forge. Most people look upon gold coins as money, something with intrinsic and unalterable value. There are some, however, who realize that the value of a coin lies in the social agreement saying that it is worth what the words stamped on its face say that it's worth. The words do not change, even if the edge of the coin has been lightly brushed with a file or a sharp knife a few times. The tiny fragments of pure gold thus obtained do not amount to very much if one files or carves the edge of one coin. If one tampers with 1,000 coins, however, that's quite another matter. Governments try to discourage the practice by milling the edges of coins during the stamping process. A milled coin has a series of indentations around its edge, and if the edge has been filed or carved, it is immediately apparent. Melodir's father had contrived a way to get around that. He had carefully crafted a set of remilling dies, one die for each size coin. A blacksmith will not handle enough coins in his entire life to make enough to pay for the effort of hammering out such equipment. Melodir's father was a genius, however. He did not make the dies for his own use, nor did he sell them. Instead, he rented them, along with the services of highly trained operators, taking a small percentage as his fee. Melodir smiled. She was positive that very few gold coins in the whole of Eosia were of true weight, and she also knew that 5% of the difference between face value and true value was stacked in ingots in the hidden vault in the basement of her own manor house near Cardos. Once she had made Stragan aware of the fact that she was a bigger and more successful thief than he was, the rest would be easy. His illusions about her nobility would fall away, to be replaced with an almost reverential respect for her consummate dishonesty. She could even show him the source of her wealth, for she always carried the most prized memento of her childhood, her father's original dyes. Even now they nestled in velvet in the ornately carved rosewood case on her dressing table, polished steel jewels, more valuable than diamonds. Even as she realized that the means to marry Stragan were at hand, she also realized that she had already made her decision. She would marry him. She would, the very next time she saw him, hoist those signal flags rather than the others. Then she thought of something else. Her father's activities had been confined to the Eosian continent. All of Tomalley was literally awash with virgin coins, unviolated by file or knife edge. Once he realized that, Stragan would not walk to the altar. He would run. Melodir smiled and picked up her hairbrush. She hummed softly to herself as she brushed her long, honey-blonde hair. Like any good Aline girl, she had attacked the problem logically. And, as it almost always did, logic had won out. Logic was a friendly and comforting thing to have around, particularly if morality didn't interfere.
"Hold it," Stragan whispered, as the three of them stared down the broad staircase descending to the third floor. "There's still somebody down there."
"What's he doing this late?" Mirtai asked. "They all went home hours ago."
"We could go ask him," Kaalador said.
"Don't be absurd. Is it a watchman?"
"I don't know," Stragan replied. "I didn't see him. I just caught a flicker of candlelight. Somebody down there opened a door."
"Some drudge working late, most likely," Kaalador shrugged.
"Now what?" Mirtai asked.
"We wait." Kaalador sat down on the top step. Stragan considered it.
"Why don't the two of you stay here?" he suggested. "I'll go have a look. If he's settling in for the night, there's not much point in camping on these stairs until morning."
He went on down, his glove-soft shoes making no sound on the mother-of-pearl tiles. When he reached the hallway below, he saw the fine line of candlelight glowing out from under a door at the far end. He moved quickly, with the confidence of long practice. When he reached the door, he heard voices. Stragan did not even consider listening at the door. That was far too amateurish. He slipped into the room adjoining the lighted one, felt his way carefully to the wall, and set his ear against it. He couldn't hear a sound. He swore under his breath and went back out into the hallway. Then he padded on past the door with the candlelight coming out from under it and entered the room on the other side. He could hear the two men talking as soon as he entered.
"Our esteemed Prime Minister is beginning to grasp the situation," a rusty-sounding voice was saying. "It's a struggle, though. Pandya Subat severely limited when something new appears on the horizon."
"That's more or less to be expected, Your Excellency." Stragan recognized the second voice. It was Teoven, the director of the secret police. "The Prime Minister is almost as much a figurehead as the Emperor."
"You've noticed,"
the rusty-sounding man replied. "Subat's not likely to ask too many questions. As long as he's aware of the situation in general terms, he'll probably prefer to let us handle things without personally learning details. And that's what we wanted in the first place." "Have you made any progress with the others?"
"Some. I have to broach the subject rather carefully, you realize. The Aline's trumpets made many friends here at court. They all listen to me, though. I hold the keys to the treasury, and that helps to get their attention. Most of the ministries are ceremonial, so I haven't wasted much time on the men who head them. The Ministry of Culture is probably not going to be of much use, or the Ministry of Education either, for that matter."
"I wouldn't be so sure of that one, Your Excellency. The Ministry of Education controls the universities. We have to think past the current emergency. I don't think either of us wants whole generations to go through life believing that Interior and Exchequer are hotbeds of treason. Technically, we are acting contrary to the Emperor's wishes.
That's true, I suppose. But Interior controls the police, and Exchequer levies and collects the taxes. We are neither one of us ever going to be very popular, no matter what we do. But you're probably right. If the history professors at the university start telling their students that we're traitors, people might start claiming that it's their patriotic duty to ignore the officers of the law, or to stop paying their taxes.
That raises an interesting point, Chancellor Gashon, Teoven mused. You've got a sort of police force, haven't you? Muscular fellows who accompany your tax collectors to make sure that people pay what they owe?
Oh, yes. One way or the other, everybody pays his taxes. I get money, or blood, from all of them.
Follow me on this, if you will. The Alenes probably know that Interior, and most likely the Army as well, are opposed to them. So they'll try their very best to disrupt our customary operations. I'd like to conceal some of my more valuable people. Do you suppose I might transfer them into your enforcement branch? That way I'll still have functional operation, even if the Alenes start burning down police stations.
I can manage that, Teoven. Is there anything else you'll need?
Money, Chancellor Gashon. There was a pained silence.
Would you accept eternal friendship instead?
Afraid not, Your Excellency. I have to bribe people. Teoven paused. There's an idea. I could probably use some form of tax immunity as an inducement in many cases.
I don't recognize the term.
We give people an exemption from taxation in exchange for their cooperation.
That's immoral,
Gashon gasped.
That's the most shocking thing I've ever heard in my whole life.
It was only a thought.
Don't even suggest something like that, Teoven. It makes my blood run cold. Can we get out of here? Police stations make me apprehensive for some reason.
Of course, Your Excellency. I think we've covered the things we wanted to keep private. Stregan sat in the dark office, listening as the two men pushed back their chairs and went out into the corridor. He heard Teoven's key turn in the lock. The blonde thief waited for perhaps 10 minutes, and then he went back to the foot of the staircase.
They're gone now,
he called up the stairs in a loud whisper. Mirtai and Kalador came on down. Who was it? Kalador asked.
The head of the secret police and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Stregan replied. It was a very enlightening conversation. Teoven's enlisting other ministries to help him. They don't know what he's really up to, but he's managed to convince several of them that it's in their own interest to join him.
We can sort out the politics later, Kalador said. It's almost midnight. Let's get to burgling.
There's no need,
Stregan shrugged.
I've found what we're looking for.
Isn't that disgusting? Kalador said to the Aton giantess. He tosses it off as if it weren't really very important. All right, Stregan, stun us with your brilliance. Make my eyes pop out, and make Mirtai swoon with admiration.
I can't really take much credit for it, Stregan confessed. I stumbled across it, actually. It is a secret room. I was right about that. We still have to find the door, though, and make sure that the documents we want are inside. But the room's in the right place. I should have thought of it immediately.
Where is it? Mirtai asked.
Right next to Teoven's office.
That's the logical place, right enough, Kalador noted. How did you find it?
Well, I haven't actually found it yet, but I've reasoned out its existence.
Don't throw away your soft shoes or your black clothes just yet, Kalador, Mirtai advised.
You hurt me, love,
Stregan protested.
I've seen Aline reasoning go awry before. Why don't you tell us about it?
I wanted to do some constructive eavesdropping, so I went into the adjoining office to listen to Teoven and Chancellor of the Exchequer Gashon's conversation.
And?
I couldn't hear a thing.
The walls are stone, Stregan, she pointed out, and they've got seashells glued to them.
There's no such thing as a soundproof wall, Mirtai. There are always cracks and crannies that the mortar doesn't seep into. Anyway, when I tried the office on the other side, I could hear everything. Believe me, there's a room between that first office and the one Teoven uses.
It does sort of fit together, Dorlan, Kalidor said to Mirtai.
The door to that room would almost have to be in Teoven's office, wouldn't it? Those documents are sensitive, and he wouldn't want just anybody to have access to them. If we'd just taken a little while to think our way through it, we could have saved ourselves a lot of time.
It wasn't a total waste. Mirtai smiled. I've learned the art of burglary, and I've had the chance to absolutely wallow in your affection. You two have made me happier than I could possibly say. The office door's certain to be locked, you know.
Nothing simpler, little Dorlan.
Kalidor smirked, holding up a needle-thin implement with a hook on the end.
We'd better get started, Stragan said. It's midnight, and it might take us the rest of the night to find the door to that hidden room.
You're not serious, Elana scoffed.
May my tongue turn green if an eye ain't, your queenship.
Kalidor paused.
Dreadful, isn't it? He added.
I don't quite understand, Sarabian confessed.
It's a cliché, Your Majesty, Stragan explained, taken from a type of literature that's currently very popular in Eosia.
Do you really want to dignify that trash by calling it literature, Stragan? Baroness Melodir murmured.
It satisfies the needs of the mentally deprived, Baroness.
He shrugged.
Anyway, Your Imperial Majesty, the literature consists largely of ghost stories. There's always a haunted castle, complete with hidden rooms and secret passages, and the entrances to these rooms and passages are always hidden behind bookcases. It's a very tired old device. So tired, in fact, that I almost didn't think of it. I didn't believe anybody would be so obvious.
He laughed.
I wonder if Teoven thought it up all by himself, or if he plagiarized. If he stole it, he has abominable taste in literature.
Are books all that available in Eosia? Oscania asked curiously. They're fearfully expensive here.
It's one of the results of our Holy Mother's drive toward universal literacy during the last century, Your Excellency, Elana explained. The Church wanted her children to be able to read her message, so parish priests spend a great deal of time teaching everybody to read.
The message of the Church doesn't really take all that long to browse through, however, Stragan added. And after that, you've got crowds of literate people with a skill they can't really apply. It was the invention of paper that set off the literary explosion, though. The labor costs involved in copying aren't particularly high. It was the cost of parchment that made books so prohibitively expensive. When paper came along, books became cheaper. There are copy houses in most major cities, with whole platoons of scriveners grinding out books by the ton. It's a very profitable business. The books don't have illuminations or decorated capitals, and the lettering's a little shoddy, but they're readable and affordable. Not everyone who can read has good taste, though, so a lot of truly dreadful books are written by people with minimal talent. They write adventure stories, ghost stories, heroic fantasies, and those naughty books that people don't openly display in their bookcases. The Church encourages lives of the saints and tedious religious verse. Things like that are produced, of course, but nobody really reads that sort of thing. Ghost stories are currently in vogue, particularly in Thalesia. It has something to do with our national character, I think.
He looked at Elana.
The business of getting the information out of Teoven's hidey hole is going to be tedious, my queen. There are mountains of documents in there, and I can't take whole platoons of people in over the roof every night to help plow through them. Mirtai, Kalidor, and I are going to have to read every document ourselves.
Perhaps not, Milord Stragan, Elana disagreed. She smiled at the blonde thief. I had absolute confidence in your dishonesty, dear boy, so I knew that sooner or later you'd find what we were looking for. I struggled for a time with the very problem you just mentioned. Then I remembered something Sparhawk once told me. He'd used a spell to put the image of Craigor's face in a basin of water,
so that Talon could draw his picture. I spoke with one of the Pandians who came along with us, a Sir Alvor. He told me that since Sophrenia refuses to learn to read Alenic, she and Sparhawk devised a way around her deliberate incapacity. She can glance at a page, a single glance, and then make the whole page come up in a mirror or on the surface of a basin of water, hours or even days later. Sir Alvor knows the spell. He's a fairly young and agile fellow, so he'll be able to creep across the rooftop with you. Take him along next time you visit the Interior Ministry, and turn him loose in Teoven's hidden closet. I rather imagine he'll be able to carry that entire library out with him in a single night.
Does it really work, Your Majesty? Kalidor asked her a bit dubiously.
Oh, yes, Kalidor. I handed Alvor a book he'd never seen before. He leafed through it in a couple of minutes, and then printed it on that mirror over there, page after page after page. I checked what he was producing against the original, and it was absolutely perfect, right down to the smudges and the food stains on the pages.
Them there Pandian fellers is real useful to have around, Kalidor admitted.
You know, she smiled, I've noticed the exact same thing myself. There's one in particular who does all sorts of useful things for me.
Chapter 13.
We don't have any choice, dear, Vanyan said to Sophrenia. We've even tried turning around and going back, but we still keep moving in the same direction. We're going to have to use the Bellium.
He looked up the gorge lying ahead of them. The mountain river was tumbling over the boulders jutting up out of its bed, sawing its way deeper and deeper into the rock with its white, roaring passage. The sides of the gorge were thick with evergreens that dripped continually in the swirling mist rising out of the rapids.
No, Vanyan, Sophrenia replied stubbornly. We'll fall directly into their trap if we do that. The Delphae want the Bellium, and as soon as Parhawk tries to use it, they'll attack us and try to kill him and take it away from him.
They'll regret it if they do, Sparhawk told her.
Maybe, she said, but then again, maybe not. We don't know what they're capable of. Until I know how they're misleading us, I can't even guess at what else they can do. There are too many uncertainties involved to be taking chances.
Isn't this what they call an impasse? Khalad suggested. We keep going north no matter how much we try to go in some other direction. And we don't know what the Delphae will do if Sparhawk tries to use Bellium to pull us out of these mountains. Why don't we just stop?
We have to get back to Mithurin, Khalad. Sparhawk objected.
But we're not going to Mithurin, my lord. Every step we take brings us that much closer to Delphaeus. We've been twisting and turning around through these mountains for 2 days now, and we're still going north. If all directions lead to a place where we really don't want to go, why keep moving at all? Why not find a comfortable campsite and stay there for a while? Let's make them come to us, instead of the other way around.
It makes sense, Lord Vanyan, Itanya agreed. As long as we keep moving, the Delphae don't have to do a thing except herd us in the right direction. If we stop moving, they'll have to try something else, and that might give Lady Sophrenia some clues about their capabilities. It's called constructive inaction in diplomatic circles.
What if the Delphae just decide to wait us out? Ulath objected. Autumn isn't a good time to linger in the mountains. It wasn't so bad in those foothills we came through when we left the desert, but now that we're up here, time starts to get very important.
I don't think they'll wait, Sir Ulath, Itanya disagreed.
Why not? They've got all the advantages, haven't they?
Let's just call it a diplomat's instinct. I caught a faint odor of urgency about them when they approached us. They want us to go to Delphaeus, right enough. But it's also important to them that we get there soon.
I'd like to know how you worked that out, Your Excellency, Calton said skeptically.
It's a combination of a thousand little things, Sir Calton. The tone of voice, slight changes of expression, even their posture and their rate of breathing. The Delphae weren't as certain of themselves as they seemed, and they want us to go to Delphaeus as quickly as possible. As long as we keep going, they don't have any reason to make further contact. But I think we'll find that if we just sit still, they'll come to us and start making concessions. I've seen it happen that way many times.
Does it take long to learn how to be a diplomat, Your Excellency? Talon asked him with a speculative look.
That depends entirely on your natural gifts, Master Talon. I'm a quick learner. Diplomacy sounds like a lot of fun.
It's the best game there is. Itanya smiled.
There's no other that even approaches it.
Are you considering another career change, Talon?
His brother asked him.
I'm never going to be a very good knight, Khalad. Not unless Sparhawk takes the Bellium and makes me about 4 times bigger than I am now.
Isn't this about the third occupation you've grown excited about so far this year? Sparhawk asked him. Have you given up the notion of becoming the Emperor of the Thieves, or the Arch-Prelate of Larceny?
I don't really have to make any final decisions yet, Sparhawk. I'm still young.
Talon suddenly thought of something.
They can't arrest a diplomat, can they, Your Excellency? I mean, the police can't really touch him at all, no matter what he does.
That's a long-standing custom, Master Talon. If I throw your diplomats into a dungeon, you'll turn around and do the same thing to mine, won't you? That puts a diplomat more or less above the law.
Well, now, Talon said with a beatific smile, isn't that something to think about?
I like caves. Ulaf shrugged. Are you sure you're not part troll, Ulaf? Kalton asked. Even trolls and ogres can have good ideas once in a while. A cave's got a roof in case the weather turns sour, and nobody can come at you from behind. This one's a good cave, and it's been used before. Somebody spent quite a bit of time building a wall around that spring in there, so that there's plenty of water. What if he comes back and wants his cave again? I don't think he'll do that, Kalton.
The big Thalesian held up a beautifully carved flint spearhead.
He left this behind when he moved out. I'd say that he'd probably be too old to give us much to worry about. 15 or 20,000 years too old, at least.
He touched a careful thumb to the serrated edge of the spearpoint.
He did very nice work, though. He drew pictures on the wall, too. Animals, mostly.
Kalton shuddered.
Wouldn't it be sort of like taking up residence in a tomb? Not really. Time's all one piece, Kalton. The past is always with us. The cave served the fellow who made this spearpoint very well, and the work he left behind inclines me to trust his judgment. The place has everything we need. Shelter, water, plenty of firewood nearby. And then there's that steep meadow 100 yards off to the south, so there's plenty of forage for the horses. What are we going to eat, though? After a couple of weeks when our supplies run out, we'll be trying to boil rocks down for soup stock.
There's game about, Sir Kalton,
Khalad told him.
I've seen deer down by the river, and a flock of feral goats higher up the slope.
Goat? Kalton made a face.
It's better than rock soup, isn't it?
Sir Ulaf is right, gentlemen, Bevier told them. The cave's in a defensible position. So far as we know, the Delphae have to get close enough to touch us in order to do us any harm. Some breastworks and a well-planted field of sharpened stakes on that steep slope leading down to the river will keep them at arm's length. If Ambassador Itanya is right, and the Delphae are pressed for time, that should encourage them to come to the bargaining table.
Let's do it, Banyan decided. And let's get right at it. The Delphae seem to come out at night, so we'll want some defenses in place before the sun goes down.
The overcast that had turned the sky into an oppressive leaden bowl for the past week was gone the following morning, and the autumn sunlight touching the turning leaves of the grove of aspens across the gorge from their cave filled the day with a vibrant golden light. Everything seemed etched with a kind of preternatural clarity. The boulders in the stream bed below were starkly white, and the swift-moving river was a dark, sun-illuminated green. The gorge was alive with birdsong and the chatter of scolding squirrels. The knights continued the labor of fortification, erecting a substantial chest-high wall of loosely piled stones around the edge of the semicircular shelf that extended out from the mouth of the cave, and planting a forest of sharpened stakes on the steep slope that led down to the river. They pastured their horses in the adjoining meadow by day, and brought them inside the makeshift fort as the sun went down.
They bathed and washed their clothing in the river, and hunted deer and goats in the forest. They took turns standing watch at night, but there was no sign of the Delphi. They stayed there for 4 nights, growing more restless with each passing hour. If this is how the Delphi respond to something urgent, I'd hate to sit around waiting for them when they were relaxed, Talon said dryly to Itanya on the morning of the 4th day. They don't even have anybody out there watching us.
They're out there, Master Talon, Itanya replied confidently.
Why haven't we seen them, then? They'd be fairly hard to miss at night.
Not necessarily, Colton disagreed. I don't think they glow all the time. We saw them shining out there in that fog the first time they came to call, but the second time they crept up to within 20 yards of us before they lit up. They seem to be able to control the light, depending on the circumstances.
They're out there, Itanya repeated, and the longer they wait, the better.
I didn't follow that, Talon confessed.
They know by this time that we're not going to move from this spot, so they're out there right now arguing among themselves about what they're going to offer us. Some of them want to offer more than the others, and the longer we just sit here, the more we strengthen the position of that faction.
Have you suddenly become clairvoyant, Itanya?
Sophronia asked him.
No, Lady Sophronia, just experienced. This delay is fairly standard in any negotiation. I'm on familiar ground now. We've chosen the right strategy.
What else should we be doing? Colton asked.
Nothing, Sir Knight. It's their move.
She came from the river in broad daylight, climbing easily up the rocky path that ascended the steep slope. She wore a gray hooded robe and simple sandals. Her features were Tamil, but she did not have the characteristic golden skin tone of her race. She was not so much pale as she was colorless. Her eyes were gray and seemed very wise, and her hair was long and completely white, though she appeared to be scarcely more than a girl. Sparhawk and the others watched her as she came up the hill in the golden sunlight. She crossed the steep meadow where the horses grazed. Kyle, Sophronia's gentle white palfrey, approached the colorless woman curiously, and the stranger gently touched the mare's face with one slim hand.
"That's probably far enough," Vanyan called to her. "What is it that you want?"
"I am Zanisha," the young woman replied. Her voice was soft, but there was a kind of echoing timbre to it that immediately identified her as one of the Delphi.
"I am to be thy surety, Lord Vanyan."
"You know me?"
"We know thee, Lord Vanyan, and each of thy companions. Ye are reluctant to come to Delphaeus, fearing that we mean you harm. My life will serve as pledge of our good faith."
"Don't listen, Vanyan," Sophronia said, her eyes hard.
"Art thou a feared priestess?"
Zanisha asked calmly.
"Thy goddess doth not share thy fear. Now do I perceive that it is thy hatred which doth obstruct that which must come to pass, and thus it shall be into thy hands that I shall place my life, to do with as thou wilt. If thou must needs kill me to quench this hatred of thine, then so be it."
Sophronia's face went deathly pale.
"You know I wouldn't do that, Zanisha." "Then put the implement of death into the hands of another. Thus thou mayest command my dying, and put no stain of blood upon thine own hands. Is this not the custom of thy race, Styric? Thou shalt remain undefiled, even as this thirst of thine is slaked. All unsmirched mayest thou face thy goddess and protest thine innocence, for thou shalt be blameless. My blood shall be upon the hands of thine Alines, and Alines' souls are cheap, are they not?"
She reached inside her robe and drew out a jewel-like stone dagger.
"Here is the implement of my death, Sophronia," she said,
The blade is obsidian, so thou shalt not contaminate thy hands or thy soul with the loathsome touch of steel when thou spillest out my life. Zenisha's voice was soft, but her words cut into Sophronia like the hard, sharp steel she spoke of. I won't listen to this, the small Styric woman declared hotly. Zenisha smiled. Ah, but thou wilt, Sophronia, she said, still very calm. I know thee well, Styric, and I know that my words have burned themselves into thy soul. Thou wilt hear them again and again. In the silence of the night shall they come to thee, burning deeper each time. Truly shalt thou listen, for my words are the words of truth, and they shall echo in thy soul all the days of thy life. Sophronia's face twisted in anguish, and with a sudden wail she fled back into the cave. Itania's face was troubled as he came back along the narrow path from the meadow to the open area in front of the cave.
She's very convincing, he told them. I get no sense of deceit from her at all. She probably doesn't know enough about the real motives of the leaders of her people to have anything to hide, Thevier said dubiously. She could very well be nothing more than a pawn.
She is one of the leaders of her people, Sir Bevier, Itania disagreed. She's the equivalent of the Crown Princess of the Delphae. She's the one who'll be Anarae when the Anarae dies.
Is that a name or a title? Uloth asked.
It's a title. The Anarae, or in Zenisha's case, the Anarae, is both the temporal and spiritual leader of the Delphae. The current Anarae is named Sedan.
She's not just making it up? Talon asked.
She could be just pretending to be their crown princess, you know. That way we'd think she was important, when she's actually nothing more than a shepherdess or somebody's housemaid.
I don't think so, Itania said. It may sound immodest, but I don't really believe anyone can lie to me for very long and get away with it. She says that she's the one who'll be Anarae, and I believe her. The move's consistent with standard diplomatic practice. Hostages have to be important. It's another indication of just how desperate the Delphae are in this business. I think Zanisha's telling the truth, and if she is, she's the most precious thing they possess. He made a wry face.
It definitely goes against everything I've been trained to believe about the Shining Ones since childhood, but I think we almost have to trust them this time.
Sparhawk and Vanyan looked at each other.
What do you think? Vanyan asked.
I don't see that we've got much choice. Do you?
Not really. Uloth was right. We can't sit here all winter, and no matter which way we turn, we keep going toward Delphaeus. The fact that Zanisha's here is some assurance of good faith.
Is it enough, though?
It's probably going to have to be, Sparhawk. I don't think we're going to get anything better.
Colton, Sophronia exclaimed. No.
Somebody has to do it, the blonde knight replied stubbornly. Good faith has to go both ways.
He looked Zenisha full in the face.
Is there something you'd like to tell me before I help you up onto that horse? He asked her. Some warning, maybe?
Thou art brave, Sir Colton, she replied.
That's what they pay me for, he shrugged. Will I dissolve if I touch you?
No.
End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.